Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working building in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Need a professional place to work from? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com.
This week on a special Valentine's Day edition of Meet in Three, we put a twist on the lovey-dovey holiday.
The mission statement is save the world through silliness and chocolate, and in parentheses, launch a chocolate bar into outer space. But I'm having some conflict on the board members with the parentheses. That's okay.
He cited that in his area there used to be 30 dairy farms and now there are 3.
You know, dessert was political, and what you had on the dessert table said more about you than other markers of success.
Tune in to Meet in 3, HRN's weekly food news and storytelling roundup wherever you listen to podcasts. Good morning. Today is Thursday, February 20th. This is the Main Course OG. Everyone hear us? Loud and clear? We got Sib in the studio, Chef Sib, who's having a little trouble on the ones and twos, but we're going to get you in. So we are the Main Course OG. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Patrick Martins.
Hello, everybody.
And I got a mini co-host in the studio, Josie Martins.
Hello.
Hello, Josie. Well, we've all got some feathers in our hair, which we're going to talk about a little bit later.
I actually got a permanent one.
And I have a feather in my hand.
A feather in your hand. Okay. I've got one in my hair, and Patrick's was woven in. So we're going to hear about these heritage breed chicken feathers
exactly.
In a bit. So President's Day, come and gone. For me, it meant more like no traffic, no school. Josie's off from school, which is why we have a special host. How is it with no school, Josie?
Good.
Yes. What are the highlights when school is closed? Do you have a special sleepover?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, in studio with us this morning are Sarah Chandler, a Jewish experiential educator, community activist, and earth-based spiritual leader, and also a jewelry designer specializing in heritage chicken feathers. So we are, I wish you could see us. We are all a little bit bedazzled this morning, whether it's earrings or hair clips. And we also have Sib Cheeseman, executive chef of Gran Electrica, one of our absolute favorite Mexican restaurants here in Brooklyn.
Hello.
Are you feeling bedazzled?
I'm bedazzled
feathered?
Right now. About as bedazzled as I could get.
Feathered and fluffy.
All right. I mean, instantly these feathers make you look a little Native American. I mean, you really feel like part of nature or look like you're Native American, basically. It's very spiritual.
I don't know. For me, it doesn't go Native American. I feel a little bit more like accessorized. Bohemian. Yeah, bohemian. I don't know if it's not Native American for me.
Well, it makes sense. Any indigenous cultures would want to use the whole animal in some way for protection, for a ritual, for clothing, for fashion.
I like it. It's a little bit of a textural difference against my hair. So we're going to jump right in with a game of word association. We picked a word for each of our guests. Respond in just a few descriptive words. Sarah, your word is compassion.
I'm supposed to say the next word that comes to mind?
Sure.
Or just a few. I mean, what do you think when you...
Well, hugging chickens is on my mind.
Okay. I like that.
Why do you say that?
Well, I think
you fight for animal rights, right?
It's true. It's true. Animal welfare is a thing that I care about a lot.
Cool.
Yeah.
And Sib, we have for you queso.
Fundido.
most likely to be dipped.
Yeah,
with
most
what?
Likely for dipping. Yeah, I love cheese. Like I think about Roberta's because we're here right now, and there's a whole bunch of cheese everywhere. I think of myself because my name is Cheese Man. So there's a lot of things that I associate with queso, but definitely.
Remind me, are you lactose intolerant?
No, I just like not with the cheese. Really good cheese and like, you know, it's really, you know, comes from a pretty healthy animal because you could get some really shoddy cheese out there. But yeah.
So queso only of the heritage breeds.
Only of the heritage breed.
Fantastic.
The best of the best.
That's what we like to hear. So we call this next section of our show our roundtable, weekly-based round robin. We have 7 or 8 questions for our guests over the next 25 minutes or so. So first up, we want to talk seasons, cycles, and rhythms. Sarah, you want to start?
Sure. So I'm always looking around and saying, what's the season? What's happening? Right now, it's about to be almost time to tap maple trees. It's a big question, like, everyone wants it to be time to tap the maple trees because they want lots of sap, but they also, you know, the earlier we tap the maple trees, the more it means that climate change is horrible. And, you know, an early date for that isn't actually the best because it could mean that there's a short season for the maple trees. And in the Jewish calendar, we just had the New Year for Trees a couple of weeks ago, celebrating fruit trees and all the things that trees give us. So I think it's fun that in my religion, that in the darkest time of year, there's a custom to actually sit with your friends, drink wine, eat fruit, and chocolate.
That's the tradition then? It's kind of like a party tradition?
Yeah, there's a ritual where you talk about the different types of fruit, and you have 4 different cups of wine with different amounts of white versus red.
Huh.
Yeah.
Very interesting. What's it called?
It's called Tu B'Shvat, which is just the name of the date. It's like saying 4th of July, the 15th of Shvat.
Do you have to be in a certain setting for Tu B'Shvat?
Good
like,
question.
Like, is it outdoors?
Good question. In ancient times, it was not a holiday that was celebrated. It was kind of like a date on the calendar, like the fiscal year for trees, basically. It's the tree's birthday. But to observe the ritual, you do not have to be outside. Most people are inside at tables and warm and together. Though I did write an article about why you should actually spend a little bit of time outside on Tu B'Shvat and how to, like, make tea from leaves of trees and that kind of fun things.
Very cool.
Sib?
Yeah, for me, I just think about new ingredients and really coming up with a new menu because at Grand Electrica, we're a super seasonal program. So we pretty much just like base all of our menu items on seasonal availabilities, everything that's locally available, you know, in Hudson Valley, along the east. So that's pretty much where my mind is at when it comes to seasons and cycles. And just pretty much just trying to find a good balance between everything that's available. Right now I'm kind of concerned because I don't know if the winter is going to last a little bit longer because, like, you know, we had like a Indian summer or whatever, and it was just like, you know, it was beautiful for produce, and, you know, we had a lot of things that lasted well into, like, December. But I'm kind of concerned that we might be a little jammed up when it comes around April and, you know, just like the new harvest, whether or not we're going to have anything that's going to be able to be usable. And then, like, you know, I'm just trying to figure out what my new menu
is. Is that because there was no winter frost, really? Like, we never... I mean, I don't want to jinx. As a person walking down the street in New York, I appreciate no snow.
Nobody really hates global warming selfishly. You know?
Well, also we need the winter to kill the bugs because I'm a gardener. I work at 2 school gardens in Brooklyn, and we just got our seeds in the mail. We're starting to seed them indoors and get them ready. But if it doesn't get cold enough, then a lot of bugs are still in the soil and they're going to eat all our plants.
Wow, interesting.
Then do you have to resort to the do you have to spray? Do you have to do things that are not organic and to go sort of the other way? Like, what does one do if they're being true to their land, but you need to remove bugs?
It depends on the scale of your farm. If you're doing a good job and you have lots of space, maybe you overplant or you're planting other things. Like, a lot of us will plant an elderberry bush because they attract parasitic moths that eat aphids or something like that. So if you're planting other things and you're planning in advance for the potential things that happen. And there are organic pesticides, but it's better to have other systems without having to spray anything.
So now does the seasons of Mexico And Mexican cuisine, are they the same as here in New York? Or do you ever stick to seasonality because something's in Mexico? Also, I know, like, what's his name in Chicago would bring in pallets of Mexican ingredients because he couldn't find them here.
Rick so, Bayless? But
your cuisine is seasonal to New York, right? Not to what Mexico might be eating.
To a certain extent, it is seasonal to what Mexico provides. Like, definitely avocados are on there. You know, we have to have salsa. So, like, you know, right now there's no tomatoes. There's definitely no avocados in New York. So certain things like that, like cilantro. There's other herbs that come from Mexico that I incorporate into the menu. So it kind of gives me a little bit of wiggle room. But as far as just like the fresh vegetables and just like, you know, other ingredients that are not, predominantly Mexican, like it's, you know, it kind of, it helps having, you know, that New York, being able to like buy from like New York and like buying from the local farms and stuff like that. So it helps to make the menu a little bit more diverse and a little bit more colorful, I feel like.
Josie, what's your favorite season? Spring, summer, fall, or winter?
Summer and fall.
Why?
Because last fall I get to jump in the leaves with my mama.
Those nice. Are good memories. Fall's my favorite too, Josie.
Fall's my favorite too. I'm in my fall of life, you know. I'm coming on 50, you know, it's fall. When's winter start? Probably 60, 65. The first cold winds come. Bones Creek.
Why? Birth is spring?
Yeah, definitely. Always? Yeah, ages of man. In medieval times, they used to, you know, divide lives up into 3 or 7 or 4. I've always liked the 4, you know. Yeah, I'm getting into fall. Leaves are starting to turn.
All right, well, I think fall is the best. I think fall is the best. So this means you're at your prime, Patrick.
Yeah.
I was going to say, what do you think how would consumers react if, you know, Mexican cuisine, for example, in New York, if a restaurant said, nope, avocados are not in season. We just have no guacamole on the menu. And there was like a 4-month.
That restaurant would be empty. Crickets.
Yeah. Yeah, people would probably lose their minds. Just like, oh, you know, essentially probably be dubbed as not authentically Mexican. And just like, yeah, nobody would come in and then.
The irony is you'd be more authentic because yeah, you'd exactly. be true to the seasonality.
Don't mess with the guac.
I'd be into that. I'd be into that. I'd go to the restaurant, though.
Yeah?
Yeah.
With no guacamole?
Yeah.
What about an Italian restaurant with no tomato sauce? People would go crazy.
Yeah. But, well, also tomato sauce is different because most, you know, they make it from a can. So you could can them seasonally. And then
can an avocado? Seasonal.
You know, the availability of turkey all year round is because of artificial insemination. You know, people know our animals are all naturally mating at Heritage Foods. And so turkeys and ducks and geese and goats and lamb are all seasonal items. And you're supposed to eat a lot of them when they come out and then really not that much during the rest of the year.
Salmon is
seasonal.
That's the other thing I wanted to say about winter is we really should be eating fewer eggs in the winter. Because chickens are laying fewer eggs. If you want to get a pasture-raised egg in February, you're importing it from, you know, from one of the farms in, you know, Atlanta or Georgia, that area. You're not going to get a local pastured egg.
Is it based on body temperature? Do chickens give less eggs?
It's based on light. And so the chickens need, if there's more light, they're going to lay eggs more eggs per week. You know, chickens, when they are laying eggs in sheds, they keep the lights on 20 hours a day. I believe 4 hours is a minimum number of dark hours for chickens who are in sheds.
I see. So when they're living outside in their pasture, they're, you know, on pasture and walking around and have access, they are much more in the normal, speaking of rhythm, they are in the normal light and dark rhythm. Interesting. All right, we have to cut back on eggs a little bit.
So a few years ago, just jumping around here, this is what we like to do on the weekly based. Food halls sounded like a dynamite idea. Now there are a few in each neighborhood. What has become of them? Talk about the food hall. I mean, when I was around, there was just... Well, Chelsea Market is like the most successful. All those food stalls are being moved to the basement to make room for like Anthropology and those fancy stores.
I mean, Chelsea Market was way ahead of its time, I think, you know, based on the... they obviously had the land, and in that neighborhood had the space for it. But it was considered like a renegade idea when they first opened it.
There's the Essex Market.
Right. There's Penzi, which is closing in 6 weeks.
It is?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, I did not know that.
And then we walked by the DeKalb Market, because I walked 13 miles yesterday. There must be 60 food stalls. 60. It's ridiculous. I mean, how can they? I don't know. It just seems like some point it's going to stop being able to be successful.
I really like Bergen. Do you know that one?
Sure.
Yeah,
because Bergen is cool. I can go there with a group of friends. This person's getting dinner. I'm just getting a beer. This person's coming with their kid who is a really picky eater. We can all sit at the same table. My friend had a birthday party. It was from like 5 to 9 p.m. and it was amazing. Everyone could eat something. Everyone could sit together. We didn't need a reservation.
Well, Bergen gives you a little bit of a community vibe too. They're not overdoing it. There's maybe 4 stalls. It's mostly seating versus a lot of these newer food halls. It's mostly food stalls, less seating.
Hard to find a seat. Yeah.
Hard to find a seat. I think the DeKalb Market expanded their seating, which helped quite a bit. But a lot of them are only lasting because of food delivery services like Caviar. You know, I think it's saturating a neighborhood to say they have more choices, even though there's, you know, it's below ground and everything like that. But you have the timeout market in Dumbo. Do you feel that in the neighborhood? Has it changed things?
Well, not for us, because we operate, you know, predominantly at night. So it's usually after they start to slow down. But definitely like going to like, you know, Butler, which is like my coffee shop, like right there on the corner. I've heard they say like, you know, that it kind of affects their business a little bit. And, you know, I guess that, I don't know. I think that it's a good thing. I like that idea. It's like it gives like, you know, I guess smaller businesses a chance to like expand a little bit. So like you have a food hall in like a neighborhood that your restaurant is not in. So you have tourists that are in that area. You have like a little taste of like what you offer at your main location, and then they'll go over there and like check it out. So like I like the idea of like having a kiosk outside of like the main location. Essentially just to like pop up. The thing that I don't like about it is that they don't rotate it enough. So if you rotate it, it should give other businesses the opportunity to use that space and use it for the same purpose that you're using it for, which is to expand your business and to expand your reach
like
to
Bergen.
Other people.
Actually, yeah, like Bergen. Maybe those are going to be the ones that last versus the
like
ones that,
that
you have to spend thousands of dollars to build out the space. It's so highly customized. Mm-hmm. And I think if that's your only location, it's very hard to do food prep, and it helps when you have like an additional commissary space or a main kitchen.
They have
a
commissary at the timeout though. They have like a whole kitchen in the back, like everything is like they have like walk-ins and they have all that stuff there. And then also like what I like about it is that I think like the new paradigm for it, like I know the North Third Market, they are basing it on how much you make a month. Mm. So your rent is essentially based on what you're making every month rather than just like a set price. So
that's how Chelsea Market is with Anne as well.
Yeah.
Talks about cheese. Yeah.
So I think that that's a good thing. It's
so
just
if you're hurting, you pay less. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and then I guess after a certain time, like, you know, if you're hurting too much, then you're just not going to be in there anymore.
Right.
So, but like.
Yeah, well, we talk about these things. Some places just seem like they'll be hurting. Like, we were mentioning the Brooklyn Navy Yards, where Russ and Daughter is. There's no parking. It's very far from a subway. Industry City, I suppose, is near a subway, but it's just so far out. I mean, is Sahadi's going to do well out there? Is there just the volume of people? Then, you know, so I think no, but then I always remember Fairway when they opened in the middle of nowhere in Red Hook. It was their second most successful store. After 75th and Broadway. So, I mean, maybe people do go out of their way. It's just like, at some point, it's going to become oversaturated. Like, there was that market on 48th and 10th Avenue or something.
Gotham.
Yeah, it closed. Yeah. Or
well, they've revamped a few times. I think it's been one of those situations where new people go in.
The Gotham market on Fulton closed, I think.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Maybe it's just... Or is it, you know, we were going to talk next about like hipster culture. Is it about going into the right place or filling a void? And if you're just going in on, let's say, North Third in Williamsburg, where there's already plenty of restaurants and great things that are unique and independent, like, is it more about location?
My experience of the Penzi as someone who is always looking for vegan food in Midtown, which was like really not like the fact that there was the Cinnamon Snail that had been this food truck that was only in the financial district. And now suddenly every time I go to Penn Station or I'm going to Madison Square Garden or I'm going to literally anything in Midtown, there's fast, delicious vegan food and donuts and beer. And there's just nothing like that anywhere. And me and the whole vegan community is just like so devastated about this situation.
Are you going to help the Cinnamon Snail open somewhere else?
Well, they just announced that they're not. Yeah,
he was like, when the Pensy closed, I'm out. Oh, man.
That's too bad. So wait, what is the state of hipster culture? Who are the hipsters now and where are they?
I don't know. I feel like everybody's a hipster right now. Everybody's just looking for, like, you know, whatever is new, whatever is hot. I guess that the issue with that is just, like, you know, things kind of just, like, rotate out too fast. And sometimes things don't have a chance to, like, become sacred and to, like, you know, kind of, like, stand the test of time. But I feel like if you don't cater to the hipster culture, you have a better chance of surviving because you're just, like, staying true to yourself. And, you know, people are going to participate in what you have to offer, you know, they will, and if not, then they won't. And then, like, you know, if you don't kind of, like, you know, bend over too much and just, like, you know, try too hard to please everyone, I feel like people kind of, like, see that, and eventually you're gonna get your crowd, and, like, you know, you'll last. But if you're trying too much to, like, try to keep up with trends, or you're trying too hard to, like, please everyone, I feel like eventually you're just gonna, like, burn yourself out, and then, you know, it's just not gonna work.
Sarah.
When I asked Mike Edison, he was like, I love that someone spends 45 minutes on my cocktail. I love that someone is shaving little bits of ice. He's like, that guy cares so much. I mean, what's the opposite? You know, is the is a, you know, factory kind of thing. And then also, he also said, Mike, every generation hates the generation that comes next. So the, oh, he's just a stupid hippie, or, you know, or he's just a disco-going thing, you know, and then everyone tries to, you know, criticize the group that comes next.
Sarah, I was going to ask you, are vegans hipsters?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what I was going to actually say was, what people want is specialization. They want their bar to look totally unique, mm-hmm. but it still has, like, all the Edison bulbs as every single other coffee shop and bar. Or they want, like, they want a cocktail menu and they want, like, some local ingredients, but, like, they don't care if every ingredient is local. And I'm seeing it in decor. I'm seeing it in, like, how things are named. Like, the names of the cocktails are, like, funny and irreverent and, like, that kind of thing. And it's actually a mix, I feel like, of old school and new school. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, we have this Moscow Mule, but it's made with, you know, ginger from this guy's farm in upstate New York. They grew indoors in a high tunnel or something like that. Or, you know, the sandwich place that I went to recently, that you could buy one sandwich or you could pay for two and pay it forward. Mm-hmm. I felt it was everything that is called Farmwich. It was like everything farm to table. But then this idea that you could buy two, this kind of like maybe socialist, like progressive, like, mm-hmm. I'm going to pay for someone else. Like, I actually think that's, things like that are like making its way into hipster culture, because it's like, I'm at a deli, but I'm eating vegan.
Yeah, I feel like hipster culture is really important to push like new ideas. I feel like people get a little annoyed by it because just like everybody wants to be on the next hot thing. But at the same time, if the next hot thing is something that's like positive and that's going to help society move forward, it's okay if it's a little oversaturated and it's like a little bit too much. Like, you kind of have to, like, I guess, you know, with human beings, like, we tend to realize, okay, it's time to like pull back a little bit. Let's balance it out. It might have gotten a little too crazy, but now we could, like, you know, even everything out and kind of like find that sweet spot where things actually work. It's like with social media, it's like with anything, like even with, like, you know, all these new food trends and diet trends, like, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but if you do it in a way that, you know, you're not educating yourself properly about how to use it and, like, what should be done and how it works for you, it could be bad. But then, you know, that does happen, but then people start to realize, okay, this person went a little crazy on it, so let me learn from that person's mistake and, like, kind of, like, you know, rein it in a little bit.
Very, very sick.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
Like, so now, jumping around, I want to ask Josie this first. Do you believe in God, and yes. What does God do? What does he do? Does God, where does he live?
In heaven.
Yeah. And does he help people?
Mm-hmm.
Is he listening to us right now?
Yes.
Do you know who believes in God? She believes in God, I think, right? You're very active in the Jewish community.
It's true. And actually, my earring company, Kanfei Shekhinah, or in English, Wings of Shekhinah, the Hebrew word Shekhinah is the feminine divine.
I was about to ask, is God necessarily a he?
Exactly.
Well, no, you're radical in the Jewish community, right? You believe in woman rabbis, right?
I do. I believe in them. My next door neighbor is one. They exist.
So now, how do you reconcile, you know, obviously science and modern medicine and, you know, all this with also believing that there's like someone listening who lives in the sky and the spirit? I mean,
that's interesting that you say it that way, because what you're describing is more of a personal God or maybe an anthropomorphic God.
Okay.
And I believe in a more of a panentheistic view where God is in everything. Everything is God. Angle. And so I definitely talk to God, but I also, you know, talk to plants and talk to chickens.
You call yourself an earth-based spiritual leader. What does that mean?
So I mainly am doing this work within the Jewish community. So I often say I'm reviving earth-based spiritual practices within Judaism. So to give the maple syrup example, when you tap a maple tree, that's not a Jewish act because we didn't have maple trees in the ancient Middle East. But if I live on a Jewish farm, I used to live on a Jewish farm called Adama at a place called Isabella Friedman Jewish Retreat Center in the Berkshires. And when we would tap a maple tree, we wouldn't just be like, this is the next thing we're doing on the farm because this is a farm. Mm-hmm. But as a Jewish farm, we would do a very specific ritual. We would sing. We would sing a line from the Psalms, "My cup overflows." We would taste the sap, which is different than the syrup because the syrup is boiled down, and say a special blessing on it, creator of the waters of the tree. And we would, you know, sit in pairs and talk about, well, what flows through you that you can share with others that actually doesn't diminish you, because that's what actually the sap is. We're not hurting the tree by taking some out. And so there's a ritual, but then there's also an opportunity to come together in community. So that's just an example of like how I might elevate an experience on the farm to Jewish earth-based spiritual practice. But I'm also doing it within traditional Jewish holidays and the Sabbath and other places like that.
Very cool. I mean, chefs are earth-based spiritual leaders too. I mean, you're connected to agriculture.
Right. And like, even when you go, I guess, back into like, you know, biblical texts, like, I guess essentially the first chefs were like priests, right? Because they used to get like the first harvest and like, you know, they used to do sacrifices and stuff like that. So like when you get like, you know, they would be the ones to like cook, you know, the baby lamb or, you know, the baby goat and like all of those things. So yeah, I guess like for me, I feel like it is kind of like a spiritual experience, like bringing people together. I feel like that's what the idea of God is, you know, or the universe. Like, you know, I like to look at it like that. Like, I'd rather say the universe rather than like God by putting like, you know, like a specific energy on it. Mm-hmm. Because like, it's not necessarily like, you know, what you were saying, Patrick, like somebody out there watching and listening. It's just like the overall vibration that kind of like brings everybody together. And I feel like, you know, when it comes down to religion and like the things that separate us is the fact that we're looking at it as being one God or my God or your God. It's like really, at the end of the day, it's like the thing that drives you and the thing that brings you together. And like, you know, just the stuff that has us on the planet. Like, I feel like all of it is design, you know, of course it's intelligent design, but also a lot of things are inexplicable. So it's just like, how do you explain those things besides saying there's some kind of like, some kind of energy or entity out there that's like binding all of these things together and like, you know, creating this, like facilitating life, I guess.
Also, the word spiritual really just means inner. So when I think about the food movement and I think about food justice, I think about animal welfare, you know, most people don't care about organic vegetables, let's say, because they literally don't know how plants grow. They don't know how much of the plant comes from, you know, most of the body of the plant actually comes from carbon in the air, and that the soil is mostly to give water to the plant. People don't have strong opinions about animal welfare and where their meat is from because they don't know how those animals are raised. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that the invisible is actually very important and something that you don't see is actually essential to our lives. To me, that's a spiritual practice of trying to think of like, well, I'm going to actually advocate for the animals. I'm going to advocate for the farmer who has to spray pesticides. Like, it's not just for my body, but it's also for, well, who's spraying those pesticides on those plants and making those choices. And the idea of being a religious leader or a spiritual leader is saying, I'm going to say that what's invisible, what you can't see, actually matters.
It's true. I mean, what would Jesus do? I mean, that's the funny thing about Republicans. It's like Jesus would be on the opposite end of the spectrum of everything they stand for and fight for, you know, maybe with the exception of abortion. But you know, I mean, that one issue keeps it. I mean, yeah, what would Jesus do? He would be against all those kind of corporate, free market, just do whatever you need to do to make a profit, you know, eat out of season, you know, it's really crazy. So what would Yahweh do? Do it Yahweh. Do it Yah's way. That's what I say.
No, as Sib was talking, I was thinking that the only, you know, this sort of idea that someone's listening and paying attention, it's more like that's where the technology companies are these days. And then everything else is more.
Oh, what's it called? Alexa?
Siri, Alexa, all of them. Yeah, like talk about, you know, asking for things or thinking about things or knowing where you're at, you know, that there is, you know, technology companies are doing that. But this idea of, you know, God and experience. And I'm a big believer in things being like meant to be. I don't know where that connects with God and religion. You know, I was raised in the Jewish religion, and I like more like traditions and things like that. But, you know, it's interesting when you talk about that we all sort of have blinders onto things that we just don't know how they work. You know, we've never grown our own, if I have not grown my own vegetables or raised my own animals, and, you know, maybe that should be a part of our more regular curriculum.
So we like, speaking of Siri, Josie likes asking Siri crazy questions. So, like, do you want to tell us a crazy question that you asked Siri? No, okay. But she likes asking the most terrible things to Siri, and Siri's like, I don't know.
Well, there was some, I mean, all of these things, especially for kids, there was an article that there was like a little boy who was ordering items off of Amazon. Like the parents just had packages showing up because the kid was talking to the Alexa and being Alexa, send us more toilet paper or whatever. And if it's linked to your account,
Anne was very upset because they wanted to hear Michael Jackson Thriller and at their friend's house, Beckett's in Portland. And Alexa was like, you don't have that one. Do you want me to just buy it for $1.99? And like, no, that's not the way the world works. You know, it's really crazy. But
yeah, you come home and your kid's talking to the Alexa, and it's like, how many things have been ordered today? Yeah,
I think also thinking about instant gratification, I always teach this concept to my students. I have mostly third and fourth graders, and I ask them, do you know what instant gratification is? And they say, no. And I say, you know, have you ever like been like out with your parents and like you see an object or like a piece of candy or a toy and you're like, I need this right now, and you're like freaking out and like you need it and like, but like actually don't need it, but you feel like you do. And I talk about that in terms of our relationship with the plants and how important it is to like watch them grow and like notice a tomato and it's like slightly ripe, but be like, I'm going to wait and eat that another time. And I think spiritual practice and meditation and gratitude practices can give us tools to be like, I don't need everything immediately. Mm-hmm. And I think that is like a plague on us, like whether it's the Alexa thing or something else, that we are so obsessed with instant gratification.
Well, talk to us about these feathers that you installed a permanent feather into my hair. Sib is wearing a beautiful group of barred rock chicken feathers in his hair. So tell us, how did this business start? Josie's holding a feather.
Yeah, so I was working in fall of 2014 with my friend Yadidja Greenberg on this project, the Hazon Food Conference, and my friend Adam Sanagera, and he was our chef, and Yadidja was a shochet, a chicken slaughterer and an animal slaughterer, and we had this idea to bring heritage chickens to this kosher event and have kosher heritage chickens for the first time in over 50 years. And Yadidja went to Frank Reese's farm, Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. He picked them up in a truck and drove them to the smallest slaughterhouse in the country in upstate New York in the Catskills. And then when we went to pick up the chickens, we said that we wanted to keep the feathers. And because we were having this four-day conference, my apprentice, Naomi Eisen, she was like, well, obviously we have to do something with the feathers. We can do hair extensions, we can do earrings. And she made a whole like activity where people could do that. And since then, I've been worked for many years as a Jewish animal welfare advocate through Farm Forward and Jewish Initiative for Animals. And I found that creating these earrings is a way to just open a conversation about heritage chickens and really the plight of most factory farm animals. Chickens tend to be like not as cute as cows or goats, and people think chickens are weird. Most people have never met a chicken. But if you can show them how beautiful chickens can be, especially if they're given 6 months to grow to their full size instead of 6 weeks, mm-hmm. you can open a conversation, and they're just so beautiful. I can't tell you how many people just gasp when they see how gorgeous these feathers are.
As a vegan, are you comfortable with feathers because they fall off and shed naturally? Or how do you walk that line?
That's a great question. So my motto is, I don't eat chicken, I just wear chicken. And most vegans would probably say, I'm not vegan because I'm wearing a chicken feather. And any animal product, no matter how you obtained it, is not vegan. So if someone wants to argue me and tell me I'm not vegan, then like, that's fine. I'll just say I eat plant-based food and wear feathers. You know, these feathers that I'm wearing right now and the ones that you're all wearing are actually from Linka Flegel, which is a queer Jewish farm in Millerton, New York. And they're also doing amazing justice programs and liberation, not just for animals, but for all people. And so I'm really excited to get their message out there. You know, I think it's more fun, actually, and more interesting to be like, yeah, I don't eat chicken. I just wear chicken. I just want to tell the story about these chickens. And, you know, if I'm not going to tell their story, who is?
That's a good tagline and a conversation starter.
Yeah, for sure. So now what do you get? So people can go to your Instagram. What is it?
Yeah, the Instagram is Wings of Shekhinah, WingsOfShekhinah, and you can see
some
pictures.
We'll put it on the show page so everybody can find it if they want to buy them. Yeah. So you have pictures and people can buy them locally, you ship?
Good question. For a while, I had an Etsy page, and it was just a lot of extra work to maintain. So right now, I'm only selling person-to-person at craft fairs in the Brooklyn area.
Cool.
It's beautiful, and these are like from different breeds. You know the breed. They're heritage feathers, so they're super strong.
Yeah.
This extension that you put on my hair is semi-permanent. It'll be on for 4 weeks. I can wash my hair.
4 months.
You have clips on.
Yeah.
Clip-ons, earrings. Now, your ears are not pierced. Is that because you worry about scarring?
Me, Emily? I just never got my ears pierced. It was not something that I wanted to do. I had a brief moment, like, you know, around high school prom where chandelier earrings and feather earrings and things that were like, you know, a little extra fun and dangly were very in, and I was going to do it. And then I don't know, maybe it's a little bit of, I think I used to think that getting my ears pierced was really going to hurt, but it's so quick that I went with a friend recently to get her ears pierced so that I could sort of, I had never been before. I wanted to see what the experience was like. So I'm like 50% of the way there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know if it's like my thing, but
well, they're very beautiful.
This might inspire me. I like my feather. I have a hair clip on right now. So we're going to take a very quick break, and then we'll be back to talk a little bit more with Sarah and Sib.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn that provides offices, co-working, event spaces, and a brand new podcast recording room. Have you been dreaming of starting your very own podcast in Brooklyn? You can now rent space in 100 Bogart's custom-built podcast room to record interviews, voiceover, and commentary. The room is fitted out with two microphones, mixing board, and a MacBook Pro running Pro Tools. You can rent the space by the hour, and a rental of an hour or more includes a 100 Bogart co-working pass. That means complimentary coffee, tea, and access to your own desk for the rest of the day. So what are you waiting for? Get started on your next audio project. 100 Bogart has the space and amenities you need to kickstart your podcast. Learn more at 100bogart.com or call their team at 718-362-3539.
This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We're here in the studio with Sarah Chandler, who is a spiritual Jewish leader and designer of heritage turkey feather.
Chicken.
Excuse me.
Chicken.
Can we do turkey?
We could, yeah.
All right. Well, Heritage Foods would like to do a little bit of turkey feathers, yeah, too. But this is chicken feather, hair extensions, and earrings. And we have Executive Chef Sib Cheeseman of Grand Electrica.
And we have Josie Martins, who is holding a feather and who has been a most excellent guest today. Thanks for being on today, Josie.
You're welcome.
And Josie did have a price to be on. She didn't want to come to the office. So,
How are we paying you today, Josie?
But what am I buying you?
My dad's gonna buy me a Sip toy Titanic.
Oh.
They're very into the movie Titanic, Max and Josie. And so we've been talking about who's real, who are the actors, like Leonardo DiCaprio wasn't really in Titanic, but then also there might not have been exactly a Jack character back in that day. So, you know, we're going through all the things that she's very upset with the guy who built Titanic, who didn't put enough safety boats for everybody.
Mm. You're so she called right.
him an SOB, yeah, which she's not supposed to curse, but she was in the back of the car and was like, that son of a bitch. So it was kind of funny. She just does not like that guy.
You're absolutely right. There should be safety for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, and because some rich people said if there were too much safety boats on the big boat, it would look too ugly, but they were wrong.
You're absolutely right.
Absolutely right. You can't worry about aesthetics. You have to worry about the safety of all the people. And some of the boats weren't even full, right? They didn't even fill them.
Yeah.
All Josie, right. I think you have a future as a perhaps an architect or a safety zone planner.
Safety boat coordinator. Yeah,
exactly. So, Sarah, we were talking before about teaching, and I know you work with children, and you do a lot of planting and farming, and tell us about, I guess, your role as a teacher.
So I teach a few mornings a week. I teach gardening in Brooklyn. And we, you know, it's funny, this thing, schools love the idea of a garden, but then they realize that most of the exciting things that happen in this climate with plants is like, you know, June and July, because that's like why we have summer vacation in this country, because 98% of Americans used to have farms, mm-hmm, and they needed their children to work on the farm, so they had school off in the summer. So it's actually a funny thing to like have a school garden, because basically you, in March and April, it's like still too cold to really grow anything. And mm-hmm, so you're just like doing a lot of like looking at the soil, and like maybe if you're lucky, you have some cover crop or garlic or something or wheat that you planted the year before that you can do activities with. And then by like the second week in June, maybe you have like a few pieces of lettuce growing and like not that much. But it's really fun. The kids love being outside. They love getting to eat things. If you've never seen a group of fourth graders literally shoving each other to eat a string bean, then I mean, you wouldn't believe it if you saw it, because you know they could be the same day be like complaining about eating green beans. So it gets them very excited about plants and their relationship to plants. And I also talk a lot about soil, rocks, and worms and spiders. We can spend the whole class just like watching a spider. And I think it's really good for their brains to be outside. I also talk a lot in the garden about teamwork, because basically, scientists and activists and leaders, we actually know what we would need to do to change our food systems and to make the planet a better place. But the reason why we're not doing it is because we don't get along and we don't listen to each other. We're not open to new ideas. We're just not strategic. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk about like what's an environmental value, like I can list all of these things of like do this to stop climate change. But when I'm with kids, especially outside and with adults also, there's a huge focus on what we call in Hebrew achdut, or togetherness or unity.
Very interesting. And now, do you have trouble navigating this Jewish culture and religion as a woman? I mean, it is a pretty male-dominated society at the very religious end of things, right? Rabbis, do they resent you? Male that's rabbis? Funny.
That's an interesting comment. I'm mostly involved in the progressive Jewish community.
Okay.
So the majority of American Jews are actually not Orthodox.
I see.
And so, and if anything, that community is very female dominated.
Oh, okay.
In terms of the non-Orthodox community, the majority of people who enter rabbinical school and finish rabbinical school are not men. They're either women or non-binary. And in terms of our leadership, I work at a synagogue where I think there are three women rabbis. The first rabbi I ever met when I was a kid was a woman. So I would say we have the same issues of misogyny in terms of like men being listened to more, women being interrupted more, or you know, nonprofits having the majority of staff being women, but then the CEO being a man, or the majority of the nonprofit is women, but the head of the board is a man. I mean, we have the same issues in those ways as outside of, but I would say in terms of progressive Judaism, women are being accepted. I'm also a Hebrew priestess, and that's a type of Jewish spiritual leader that is not meant to replace a rabbi, but to be more, you could say, socialist or communal in terms of, you know, the instead of being a sage on the stage, I'm a guide on the side, and putting together, you know, groups of people that are more communal and not just like, hey, I know everything and I'm going to tell you what to do. You better listen to me because I have a direct line to God.
Well, you get to touch the Torah then, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's cool. That's very hard, right? Very
touching the Torah?
No, I mean, what is it? The thing that they carry around?
Yeah, that's a Torah. Yeah.
But so, you can touch the Torah. I mean,
totally. I touched the Torah the other day.
You said that. Didn't you tell me something in the car that, like...
Oh, okay.
Maybe oh, no, you get to rewrite the Torah because I have to update it because it gets faded.
Yeah, so I represent this amazing Soferet, who's a Hebrew scribe. It's like a calligrapher, but someone who writes with turkey feathers on animal skin. Her name is Julie Seltzer, and she writes Torahs, and it's extremely rare. There's only a handful of women who have done it, and she repairs Torahs, and I help her with her business plans and such. And
is there a preferred breed of turkey feather to write the Torah with? Maybe the Narragansett, the Jersey Buff?
I love that question. So it doesn't have to do with the breed of turkey. It has to do with how thick the feather is. So if you think of like a reed or plant or something like that, it has to do with the thickness.
So is that more based on the age of the turkey?
It has to be a certain age, but it also has to do with which part of the body the feather is from. So there's like more than 29 different types of feathers in a body of a bird.
Really?
So, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Fascinating.
Something to learn. And I have one right now on my hair permanently. Have
chicken feathers.
Chicken feathers. But anyway, did you mean turkey feathers? 29 kinds of turkey feathers?
I don't know as much about the turkey feathers. There might even be more than 29.
Wow.
So, Sib, tell us about the agave dinner you have coming up at Grand Electrica, and, you know, what's new on the menu at spring and why New Yorkers should go towards Dumbo and check out your place if they haven't already.
So we are having an agave dinner, which is essentially just like a way of like bringing people together, you know, creating a community, and then also educating people that might not know a lot about agave, which is like, you know, the sugar that's used to process and make tequila and mezcal. So it's really about just like educating, and then also just like having a fun environment where, you know, I could try out some new things, you know, and just like kind of like do something that's like off the beaten path of the regular menu. And so we're having one next month on the 23rd, which is going to be for the 8th anniversary of Grand Electrica. So it should be.
Are you collaborating with any particular meat company that's special? Or
Yes, I'm collaborating with a very special meat company, Heritage. Okay. I'm collaborating with you guys. Also, El Jogorio Mezcal, which is essentially, I like to say, it's like the heritage of mezcals.
It was delicious. I ordered one two days ago.
Very good. Like, they have so many different expressions, and they essentially just like use the most like natural and just like I guess just the best practices of like creating mezcal. Right now, mezcal tends to get a little watered down. You know, that is like starting to become more prevalent and popular in the, you know, in the mainstream culture. But they try to stay, you know, true to their origins and just like use the best mezcaleros to produce their mezcal. And honestly, it makes the best mezcal ever. Like, I love drinking El Jogorio. I try not to drink it too much at work because it's pretty expensive. So I don't want to be responsible for finishing off a whole bottle, but I think that I have done that over the course of the last year. So
it's interesting that mezcal's really taken off. I mean, that cocktail culture took off, I don't know, 20, 15 years ago. There's still a lot of cities that don't have cocktail bars in America.
Yeah.
And then, so that's a big revolution. And then, you know, mezcal. I mean, it must have. It's always existed. It's just now, all of a sudden, it's the way champagne on wine lists, that section is greatly expanded.
I don't know if it says something about importers or if it says something about the demand from chefs or bartenders, chefs, or bar programs that have a certain palate and want something that is more, you know,
They produce culture chefs. They introduce something, a new breed of avocado, and then all of a sudden it hits, and then it's a farmer's market. It's amazing, you know, the way it drive culture.
Yeah, I feel like it's like it's kind of like, you know, I feel like it's like the new wine, because like for an agave plant to like reach full maturity takes about like, you know, 15 years or more. So like that being like the rarity of it is one thing. It kind of lends back to like, you know, what we were talking about earlier with the hipster culture. It's just like, you know, it's a new thing and it's like, you know, something that's a little bit different. So everybody's kind of like clamoring for it right now. Also, for people that like tequila, I feel like, you know, it's a way better alternative to tequila. Like, there's not as much sugar in it.
Cleaner taste.
Yeah, cleaner taste. You know, it has, like, the smoky quality. Like, for me, I love, like, a very, like, you know, earthy, you know, herbaceous vegetal mezcal. So it's, like, it's a good alternative from, like, you know, like, say, a scotch or something like that.
I don't think I have the palate for it. I'm trying. No. I'm trying to drink mezcal little by little, but I don't love smoke. Taste. I don't love smoky flavors.
Speaking of acquired taste, Josie, what is your favorite food in the world that we ate, we opened up a day ago?
Caviar.
Yes. She likes caviar. Oh. The black kind, which is more expensive, but
speaking of a good palate,
I know she loves caviar. In fact, we cannot leave Josie alone with the caviar when we do open one because she will finish it.
It's like leaving you with an Alexa. You know, instead of ordering things, you just eat all the caviar.
She's like, what color is my butt, Alexa? And she's like, how would I know that?
She's like, anyway. Well, let me order some caviar.
But yeah, so. Well, yeah, so it was the 23rd, our 8th anniversary, of March.
Which is a Monday.
All of our agave dinners are on Mondays, just so it's like more of like an industry event. So it's like, you know, because Monday usually like industry night, you know, some restaurants close on Mondays and like, you know, mostly like chefs and, you know, people that work in the restaurant industry have Mondays off. So we kind of do it to kind of as like an homage to that. And then it's also like the slowest.
On Monday.
Yeah, it was crazy this Monday. I wasn't expecting it. I told my friends to come over. I was like, "Yeah, come by. It should be slow. I'll come in. You know, I can hang out."
It was President's Day. People were.
You don't think of President's Day as a holiday that people like want to come out.
I think if you don't have kids or you don't teach, it's not on your radar.
It is.
I was very surprised. I was a little slammed when Patrick came in. I was just like a little frazzled, but you know, it was fun.
You still made time to come out.
Yeah, you know, I like it because, like, in the wintertime, it kind of drives me a little crazy because, you know, our summers at GE are insane. You know, it's just, like, constantly. Well,
Grand Electrica has an amazing backyard.
Yeah, it has a very beautiful backyard. Everybody comes to see the backyard. You know, doubles our capacity in the summertime. And it just makes for an awesome vibe. But, you know, in the wintertime, it kind of slows down a little bit. And it's just, like, a little bit more of a relaxed vibe. So, like, you know, it gives me more time in the winter to, like, work on more thoughtful dishes and, like, kind of just, like, work with, like, more delicate ingredients. And
best rice and beans like in the city, Anne said, with a kiss of coconut.
A kiss of coconut. Yeah, I like that. I like the kiss of
now,
coconut.
Now, Sarah, will you eat out if it's not... So, are you kosher and vegan?
Love that question. I eat plants. I eat in restaurants that are not... don't have kosher certification, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
I think that suits your progressive, also wearing feathers vibe.
Yeah. Also,
Sib's worst nightmare. Table one, we have a kosher vegan.
No, I mean, but also the kosher industry is also super corrupt. And also most places, even if they have kosher supervision, that can only be done by a man. And it's like, you know, there's so many layers to it.
Does halal, kosher kill, does that mean anything? I mean... I know it means something for the religion. Is there anything? Isn't it less humane for the animal?
I love that question. So halal, which is the certification for a, you know, Islamic or Muslim animal slaughter, zbicha, or kosher, which is the certification for a shchita of an animal. So the question is an animal that was slaughtered according to halal or slaughtered according to kosher, is either of those more or less humane than conventional slaughter?
Mm-hmm.
So the short answer is it depends on the animal, and it depends on the size of the facility, and it depends on how much training the person has who's doing the slaughter.
So it's less humane.
So there are situations where, for example, and it also depends what we're comparing it to. So if we're talking about chickens, mm-hmm. for example, in a large scale industrial non-kosher, non-halal chicken facility, how are those chickens being slaughtered? They're having pre-slaughter stunning, and they're probably having electric water baths for their pre-slaughter stunning. And because in America, the electricity level is significantly lower than in Europe, some of those chickens survive the electric water bath. And so they're still going down the, mm-hmm. What's the word?
Shoot.
Conveyor belt, and yeah. they're alive. And then that's like the most torturous possible thing for electric water bath. Whereas if you have a small, very, very small, let's say kosher slaughter facility mm-hmm. where the kosher person, the person who's the shochet has, you know, done thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of chickens before, one man, one knife, one chicken, every cut is clean and checked and checking the knife every few minutes, that's significantly more humane for the chicken.
Although if it was a small facility that was not kosher and it was generations of, you know, and of experience right. and knowledge, it could be exactly the same.
It could be exactly the same, except right now, if you want to be getting animal welfare certifications, you have to have pre-slaughter stunning, mm. and a kosher facility is not going to have that. And so the question is, what is the pre-slaughter stunning method? Is it gas? Is electrifying? Is it a bullet? Is it a bolt, et cetera?
Well, we also, Patrick and I often talk about, you know, a lot of the animal welfare certifications are just certifications. They're just that. They're not necessarily, as you're saying, like a kosher facility may not meet animal welfare policy.
They're not eligible. They're not eligible for them. So like if you go to Fairway and you get kosher chicken, those chickens were raised on the same farm as a certified humane non-kosher chickens. But I'm pretty sure, I know I'm on the air, but I'm pretty sure. But
you can throw Fairway under the bus. They're going out of business.
But the kosher chickens are not eligible. Even if the chickens were raised outside and like had lots of space and had a good life, they're not eligible to get the certified humane logo on the kosher things because they didn't have pre-slaughter stunning.
It's the same way we have animals that are not certified organic, but they've been raised under organic practices.
The certifications are legit, though.
Pay for themselves, or Whole Foods pays for GAP certification. Yeah. I mean, it's all
some of them are legit, though. Like AWA, animal welfare approved, I've seen very legit. I know a farm in Westchester that has it, and you know they went and checked her out, and they were like, your ramp for your chickens to go back in the coop needs to be longer so that they don't have to go up as steep of a ramp. And that was like one of the things they needed for them to, you know,
I should dye that it. Nicely. So, yes, so on a longer ramp. On a nicely angled ramp. So we had a great show today. Who's on next week?
Next week we have Patrick McAndrew, who used to be a host on Heritage Radio Network of Why Food,
I believe. I forget exactly what he does, but it's something to do with memory. He has a mechanism. It's a school of thought that allows people to memorize.
Sounds like you're going to need it, Patrick.
Yes.
If it's escaping
you. And we have?
No, just Patrick is joining us next week.
I see, okay.
And he has the group he works with is called the Bowery Common, but we'll learn more about what that means.
Very cool.
All right. Well, thanks, thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day. And we'll have more information about the feathers on the page for today's show.
Say thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.